I'm Lynn Neary. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is out sick today. Coming up, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visits Latin America. That's in a few minutes. But first, a terrible pre-dawn earthquake in Chile this past Saturday has damaged more than 1 million buildings and killed more than 700 people. Reporter Annie Murphy is on the ground in the port city of Talcahuano, scene of some of the worst damage. Thanks so much for joining us, Annie.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of what it's like there. How badly is the city damaged?
It's a mess. A lot of the buildings are still intact, but what really did a lot of damage here, I mean, a lot of the buildings are also not intact, but what did most of the damage here is the sea. There was a huge swell. Some people are calling it a tsunami. Some people are just calling it a sea rise. It's hard to get a big read on what it was exactly, but the sea entered almost a kilometer into the city. So it's just mud and trash, dead animals, people scavenging in the wreckage. Right now, you can see the military is in town. There's some shots that were just fired. We're in the Central Plaza. It's just very chaotic, unorganized. No one seems to know what to do. A lot of people are worried that there's going to be another surge in the afternoon.
Now, the mayor of Concepcion yesterday criticized the federal government's response to the earthquake, saying that the key first 24 hours were just lost. Why? What did the government fail to do during that key time?
It seems that the government just wasn't here during that time. The military arrived yesterday afternoon around the same time that I arrived from Uruguay, so it took them a very long time to get here. And in that time, people just had no idea where to go. They didn't know if they should go back to their homes. They didn't know if they should try to leave the city. It's just everyone kind of trying to figure out what to do themselves. And what has actually been the strongest structure here, it seems like, are neighborhoods, people's families, and, you know, just local people.
So it sounds like people are pretty frustrated with the government response.
They're incredibly frustrated. They feel forgotten. They feel abandoned.
Now, yesterday there were also instances of looting in Concepcion. How's the government responding to that, and how bad is that situation?
That's why the military is here. The military was sent in to keep control of the looting. It seems like it's better today in the main squares. You have a military station, then in front of department stores, things like that. People are really, on one hand, they're glad that there's a little more order, but they also are feeling a lot of rage because the government, their first response as of now, has been to send military without any provisions. So they're seeing some order in their towns, but they're not seeing any food, water, or other services.
So all of those sort of basic services are limited or non-existent? I mean, are people getting food and water or at all?
People are getting some water. Again, neighborhood groups have come together and, you know, cracked open fire hydrants, things like that. Food, people are subsisting off what they had in their homes. A lot of people are talking about just making biscuits out of flour. Here in Talcahuano, there was a company that made flour that the earthquake destroyed, so people went there and salvaged flour from that, and they're frying that up into biscuits, but people have very little right now.
Where are people living? Where are people sleeping?
Wherever they can. If someone has a family member whose house is still intact, because many of them have been ruined, a lot of people are crowding into those homes. Sometimes people don't have anywhere to go, or they're too afraid to go inside, so they're sleeping outside. It's really cold right now. I'd say it's probably about 50 degrees outside. So it's kind of catch as catch can right now. A lot of people in their cars, if they have cars.
Tough situation. And this comes just after last month's terrible earthquake in Haiti, but there's been relatively less destruction and loss of life in Chile. Why is that?
First of all, the construction in Chile is much sturdier. Chile is obviously a much more developed country than Haiti in that sense. And people also are accustomed to earthquakes here. This is a very large earthquake that happened, but people are used to having earthquakes occur over the course of a year, so they know what to do. They know that after an earthquake, if you live on the coast, the sea is probably going to rise. They go inland. They look for high ground.
So now that the military is there, what's expected to happen within the next, you know, couple of days?
And, you know, I expect that they're going to bring food, water, try to get up telecommunications again, try to set up makeshift housing. I spoke to the military this morning, and the captain that I spoke to said these were all plans that they had, but he couldn't give me dates or times or locations that they were going to do it. It seemed like they were very fresh on the ground and trying to figure out what their plans were as well.
How are people on the ground there learning about what's going on? What's the situation with radio, television, communications?
On the local level, there's one radio station in Concepcion, which is operating, called Radio Bio Bio. That's where most people are getting information from. But that radio is spending most of their time actually broadcasting names of people, like local people that are looking for family members. In terms of information from outside, there's no information. Everyone I've been interviewing, when I go out into the street and people realize that I'm foreign press, everyone is asking, what is going on? What are they saying in the capital? When can we expect supplies? No one has any information here, really, from outside.
Reporter Annie Murphy from Talcahuano, Chile. Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in South America on the first stop of a five-nation tour that includes a visit tomorrow to Chile. To talk about the earthquake there, as well as the state of relations between the U.S. and Latin America, we're joined now by Moises Naim. He's the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Let's talk first about the earthquake. President Michelle Bachelet yesterday decided to send troops to the hardest-hit region, which has been the site of looting. And given her own personal history with the Chilean military, I wonder if you think this might have been a tough decision for her.
No, not at all. Part of her personal history is that she was the Minister of Defense of Chile. So she is very well known in the military. She knows them well. And the military today are very, very different from what they were when they were in power during the Pinochet years.
Now, Chile has now asked for international help, but initially there was some hesitation. Why?
One has to understand that this is one of the biggest earthquakes ever, and that there is a certain amount of confusion and disorganization, and people are baffled and disoriented. It's very normal. And so, you know, they probably did not know and did not have a full understanding of the scale and scope of the needs that are coming forward, that will be needed.
I want to turn now to Secretary Clinton's trip. During the previous administration, many Latin American leaders felt that Latin America was being sort of shunted aside, that it was no longer considered very important. Is that changing under Secretary Clinton and President Obama?
Well, they tried, and one needs to understand that this is a long-felt perspective from Latin America. Latin America always feels, for good reasons very often, that it is not at the very high level, doesn't get a lot of attention in Washington and elsewhere. And there was an initiative just early in the President Obama's administration. He went to a summit in Trinidad where he had all sorts of very good overtures. He's developing a very strong relationship with Mexico. He tried at the beginning to develop a very consistent view about the Honduras situation, consistent with the rest of the region, and he tried to develop a very close relationship with Brazil. Unfortunately, in all of those cases, his overtures were either rebuffed or not well, the reply was not very effective on the part of Latin America.
So what are the main points of discussion likely to be during this trip?
Well, paradoxically, it's going to be Iran. One of the of course, Secretary Clinton is going to say that there is a policy towards Latin America, that Latin America is a priority, that there are all sorts of initiatives that the United States wants to develop with the region and with specific countries. But one important item in the agenda is a visit to Brazil. Brazil has developed close ties with Iran, and the Secretary Clinton wants to use that visit to explain to the Brazilians what are the stakes concerning Iran's nuclear program and what is the U.S. positions, and hope to get Brazil's support for the U.S. position.
What is she likely to hear from Brazil?
Probably not much that will make her happy, but it has become a very important point for Brazil to show its independence. President Lula personally is very committed to show that Brazil is now a global player that does not take instructions from the United States, and it has become kind of a point of honor for him and the Brazilians to show their independence.
Yeah. Now, what about Cuba?
Well, Cuba is an evergreen. Cuba is always there in the conversations, but you know, it's not that important anymore. It continues to be important in the minds of some leaders giving speeches, but in the practical realities of the daily realities of Latin Americans, Cuba does not matter much.
And let's talk about Venezuela. Secretary Clinton is not visiting Venezuela. She's not meeting with President Hugo Chavez, but is he the elephant in the room here?
In many ways, he is. But in many ways, it's very important to understand that for him and for his political base and for his international image, it's very important not to have a very harmonious relationship with the United States. He has, during the Bush years, those were the golden years for him, because as President Bush and others, lack of popularity around the world and in Latin America soared, he capitalized on that. And now with Obama, he has more of a difficulty of doing it. But still, for him, it's very important to show that he is a loggerhead with what he calls empire.
Secretary Clinton wants to talk about Iran, but what are some of the issues she may hear about from the Latin American leaders themselves? What might come back at her?
It's going to vary from country to country. One of the things she's going to find is that this is a deeply divided region where countries are pursuing different approaches. She will hear different things in Argentina from what she hears in Brazil. But in general, trade, there are very important issues concerning trade and the fact that that there has been complete paralysis in the initiatives and concerning more trade agreements, and climate change and the deep frustration about the lack of movement in that area.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Lynn.
That was Moises Naim, and he is the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is out sick. Coming up, as film lovers look forward to the Academy Awards, Tell Me More begins our series on great black movie actresses with a tribute to Dorothy Dandridge. She was the first African-American woman to be nominated for Best Actress. That's in a moment. But first, as Secretary Clinton tours Latin America, she'll likely hear about Cuba. And here to explain why is NPR correspondent Tom Gelton. He's a longtime observer of the tricky and prickly relations between the U.S. and Cuba. He joins us now in our Washington studio. So good to have you with us, Tom.
Hi, Lynn.
So we just heard Moises Naim say that Cuba perhaps is not as important as it once was when you're looking at Latin American policy overall. Why not? Or do you agree with him?
No, I totally agree with him. I think that the only way that Cuba is important to Latin American nations is as a way to demonstrate something else that Moises said, and that is their independence from the United States. Moises pointed out that Brazil is very anxious to show it does not take instructions from the United States. I think you could extend that to all of Latin America. And the issue that really symbolizes that for many Latin American leaders is Cuba. The United States, from the early 1960s, has made a really big effort to get Cuba excluded from Latin America meetings, got Cuba kicked out of the OAS, the Organization of American States. And as the region has matured and developed its own political identity, there's been a real resentment that the United States continues to sort of force this issue on them. In fact, an important meeting that took place last week, Lynn, in Cancun, Mexico, was a meeting of what used to be called the Rio Group. Basically, it's all the Latin American and Caribbean nations except for the United States and Canada, but it does include Cuba. So they are really trying to redefine their own regional organizations in a way that says we are no longer just going to follow the U.S. tune. And I think in that context, it's in that context that Cuba is important to them.
And in terms of U.S.-Cuban relationships, 6 months ago or so, things seemed to be improving, but now there's been a deterioration again. Why? What's happening?
I think it goes back actually longer than 6 months. You know, it really goes back to when President Obama took office in January of last year. About 3 months later, in April, he gave a speech at an Inter-American summit in Trinidad in which he said that the United States favors, quote, a new beginning with Cuba. And here was an African-American president speaking, and he said that don't blame me for policies that were put in place before I was even born. And You know, Cuba now has an Afro-Cuban majority population. So here you had an African-American president talking about the need for a new beginning with Cuba and speaking to a largely Afro-Cuban population. And I think that that tone really sort of set off some alarm bells in Havana, because I think there is one of the things that we have seen over the years is a concern on the part of Cuba's leaders that if relations with the United States really do take a dramatic turn for the better, it might actually make things more difficult for them at home. It'll sort of remove, you know, one of the longstanding excuses they have for the terrible shape of the Cuban economy, for the lack of political rights in Cuba. And so, you know, it was interesting after President Obama made that declaration was when we did begin to see a real decline in U.S.-Cuban relations. And it really culminated last December, Lynn, when the Cuban authorities arrested a man by the name of Alan Gross, who was working for a development company in Maryland, who had a contract from the Agency for International Development, USAID, to distribute cell phones and some laptops in Cuba. The Cubans arrested him, said he was an agent of the U.S., said he was an espionage agent. He's been held without charges ever since. So we really do see relations sort of going back into the cooler, in a sense.
Now, just quickly, Tom, if you could explain, a Cuban dissident, Orlando Zapata, died recently on a hunger strike in prison. What's the significance of that in all this?
Well, Orlando Zapata, 42 years old, is one of 75 Cuban political prisoners arrested in March of 2003. He went on a hunger strike, and the Cuban authorities actually denied him water and put him in front of an air conditioner naked so that he developed pneumonia. At the last moment, they put him in a hospital, but he died hours later. It's the first political prisoner who has died as a result of a hunger strike in Cuba in about 15 years, a real black eye to the Cubans and an embarrassment to the Castro government.
NPR correspondent and longtime Cuba hand Tom Gelden. Tom, good to have you with us.
Anytime, Lynn.
Military and political leaders are searching for a resolution on the controversial "don't ask, don't tell" policy that prevents gay people from serving openly in the military. President Obama called for a repeal of the law in his State of the Union speech in January. The debate over that policy has prompted some observers to rethink another exclusionary policy in the U.S. Armed Forces and ask if it's time to allow women to serve in combat. Catherine Ross is among those who believe it is. She served in the Army Reserves for 8 years, including deployments in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. She explained her position on women in combat in a recent online commentary for the New York Times, and Catherine Ross joins us now from her home in Columbus, Georgia. Welcome to the program, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in that commentary, you argued that, quote, the military's policy on barring women from combat doesn't match reality, unquote. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean, from what I experienced and from what some of my fellow female soldiers experienced, we are already being attached to ground combat units. We're already in combat zones. We're already being engaged in, you know, direct contact with the enemy. So for me, the reality is that females are already in combat. We're already engaged in it. It doesn't match the policy, though, because the policy says, you know, no women in combat.
Well, maybe you can explain that by explaining what you did. You were a civil affairs sergeant in Iraq. What were your duties, and how were they essentially combat duties?
Well, I was part of a four-person team, and my team was attached to an infantry battalion. And right there, we're kind of bending the rules because females, again, are not supposed to be found at the battalion level of a ground combat unit. But we were attached to this battalion, and we went everywhere that they did. My team had to go outside the wire. That's what we say when we have to leave our operating bases and go to, say, a school or a medical facility to conduct an assessment. You know, we had to go outside the wire pretty much every day that we were there. And every day that you leave the wire, you're at risk for IEDs, small arms fires, rocket-propelled grenades. So you face these dangers the same as the infantry did. And I pulled security. I always wanted to be able to pull my own weight. You know, I never wanted to be, you know, like this princess being ferried around. I faced the same risks, you know, and I pulled some of the same duties. When we were at our operating base, I pulled guard just like all the other infantry men.
So, of course, you were armed and you could have responded if you needed to
exactly.
with your weapon.
Right.
Which essentially feels to you like combat duty, I would say.
Right. I mean, it doesn't encompass all. I mean, I wasn't trained to be an infantryman. That wasn't my job. My job was to deal with civilians. And when a lot of my job was formulated, it was kind of formulated to happen after combat had taken place. But, you know, the way the war is right now, it's not really possible. Everything just kind of happens all at once.
Now, women make up just 14% of the Army. Do you have any idea how many women really are interested in combat positions?
You know, to be honest, I don't know. I've definitely spoken with some women who are interested, and, you know, they feel like there's this opportunity that's being kept from them. I can say for me personally, I wouldn't necessarily be jumping up and down to be an infantryman just because that's not the job that interests me. My interest was more with dealing with civilians. For me, this is an issue of principle. Just the idea that women are being kept from certain jobs just based on the fact that they're women. But I do think that there are definitely women out there. I wouldn't be able to put a number on it, though.
Now, in your piece, you say that you didn't really encounter any problems with your male colleagues. You even had to live in very close quarters with them. But we know that there have been cases of female service members facing harassment, perhaps worse in the field. So as the military tries to deal with issues of women in the military in non-combat positions, mm-hmm. providing them with safe circumstances, are they ready to deal with the whole issue and the problems that might arise out of women in combat?
Well, I do think so because, you know, I have to say, I mean, I've worked both in the civilian sector and obviously in the military. And when I was in the Army, I felt like the Army, out of any of the employers I have ever had, the Army was the most concerned with sexual harassment and sexual assault. And they are the only ones who would take the time every couple months, we would be briefed on the proper procedures on how to deal with any kind of incident, you know, who we're supposed to report to, all the different options that are available to us. You know, if we were afraid of going directly to our chain of command, you know, we had other options that we could use, like the Inspector General, for instance. I felt like I was very much informed on the issue. It was reassuring to me. And I mean, I did face some sexual harassment, but it never, you know, I reported it to the chain of command right away before it could get out of hand. And so it was nipped in the bud right away. I mean, it was taken care of. I felt like I was adequately protected. I was protected the way that I should have been protected. Hmm. So, I mean, I do think that terrible things do happen, absolutely, but it's not necessarily the norm. And I feel like, you know, having a certain amount of media bias towards it kind of gives the impression that females in the Army are nothing but victims, and I just don't think that's the case.
Catherine Ross is a former Army reservist who served in Iraq. You can find a link to her New York Times opinion piece on our website. Just go to npr.org and select Tell Me More from the program page. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
This Sunday, some of Hollywood's best and brightest will come together for what's considered the most prestigious award ceremony of the year, the Oscars. Actors and actresses will be honored for some of their most memorable performances. And all of them will recognize in their acceptance speeches some of the people they would have never been able to do without. So we decided to do the same. Today we begin our week-long series on some of the most influential and inspiring African-American actresses of all times. We call it Divas on Screen. And we've invited film critic and professor Mia Mask to tell us more about some of these amazing women. We begin with a movie star from the 50s, Dorothy Dandridge.
In the 1950s, Dorothy Dandridge was one performer who paved the way for subsequent generations of black actresses. Dandridge started out as a nightclub singer and actress who sang in supper clubs in the 1930s and 40s.
I want a brown gown with a zop top with a hip lift, a lace waist in the sharpest thing. See my Sunday man. I want a scat hat with a trim brim, a zag bag with a rip zip to look plenty hip. See my Sunday man.
She made appearances at swanky hotspots like the Cotton Club and the Apollo Theater. Eventually, Dorothy began receiving offers to appear in small and uncredited roles in films like the Marx Brothers comedy A Day at the Races and Sun Valley Serenade. Much of Dandridge's career was marked by the struggle for quality roles. She was caught at the intersection of converging social forces, social conservatism and sexual liberalism. On the one hand, the Hays Production Code regulated content to appease white middle-class decorum, which meant that the cult of domesticity required women to be devoted to homemaking. While on the other hand, the war helped popularize the image of the sexually ebullient film star pinup and the sexy sweater girl.
All I want to know is do you, don't you? Baby, will you, won't you? Please make up your mind what you say. Do I get that little kiss? What you say? Must you let me down like this? Time's a-wasting. What's it all about? I just want to know whether I'm in or out. What you say?
All of this was further complicated by the fact that 1950s America was not willing or able to accept black women playing professional and or dignified characters. However, in 1953, Dandridge landed a starring role in The Bright Road, a little-known film with a nearly all-black cast. In the film, Dandridge plays Jane Richards, a young fourth-grade teacher in the South who has a problem in her classroom with an 11-year-old student. Her Bright Road co-star was Harry Belafonte, who played the school's principal. The film demonstrated their romantic chemistry, which was evident in their next picture, Carmen Jones.
Carmen.
Go to flying school. Take off right now. Then lay in your bunk. Look up at them pin-up gals. See what that gets you, droopy drawers.
I got something I want you to see. That's been with me all the time. Right here, where you are.
That don't ring so true.
I swear it's true.
Dandridge landed the title role in the all-black cast musical Carmen Jones, based on George Bizet's celebrated opera Carmen. While the operatic voices were dubbed by professional opera singers, the film enlisted several brilliant black actors, including Brock Peters, Diane Carroll, and Pearl Bailey. It was the first film to put her sexual charisma to good use.
Hey, Carmen, how about going to passes with me tonight? I can dance those other guys throughout the floor.
T-Bone, you're too little and too late.
I don't waste no time. Dig me, baby?
You're wasting your time right now, Sergeant. The wind's blowing in another direction. Ain't no use arguing with the wind.
For her role as Carmen, Dorothy Dandridge earned an Oscar nomination for Best Actress in 1954. She was the first African-American woman to receive an Academy Award nomination in this category.
Love's a baby that grows up wild, and he don't do what you want him to. Love ain't nobody's angel child, and he won't pay any mind to you. One man gives me his...
Mia Mask is an associate professor of film at Vassar College. She's the author of Divas on Screen, Black Women in American Film. To read more about Dorothy Dandridge and see video clips from her hit classic Carmen Jones, please go to the program page of NPR.org and select Tell Me More. Tune in again tomorrow when Mia will tell us about one of the most iconic actresses of the 70s, the revolutionary Pam Grier.
You go for me and I'm taboo, but if you're hard to get, I go for you. And if I do, then you are through, boy. My baby, that's the end of you. So take your cue, boy. Don't say I didn't tell you true. I told you truly, if I love you, that's the end.
I'm Lynn Neary. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is out sick. Coming up in your ear with the music group Los Amigos Invisibles. But first, for the last few weeks, NPR's investigative team has worked with reporters at the Center for Public Integrity, or CPI, on a sensitive topic, sexual assaults on college campuses. The center interviewed 33 students who reported having been sexually assaulted by another student. Only four alleged attackers were expelled, and two of those after multiple accusations of sexual misconduct. But one campus that is taking a different approach is the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. There, a young sexual assault victim did find a measure of justice when the school expelled her attacker. And I want to mention that this story might not be appropriate for some because the discussion does involve some explicit details. Host Michelle Martin recorded this conversation last week, and she was joined by Paul Irish, the Dean of Student Conduct and Community Standards at the College of the Holy Cross, and Kristen Lombardi, a staff writer at the Center for Public Integrity. She reported a series of stories on this topic. Lombardi talked about how the CPI gathered data for this investigative series.
We got our hands on the only database on sexual assault proceedings at institutions of higher education nationwide, and it shows that schools rarely expel students who are found responsible for sexual assault. Much more common were seemingly modest penalties, such as reprimands, counseling, community service, suspensions. The data also included other restrictions. In our interviews with administrators, they told us that would typically be educational penalties like required alcohol treatment.
One of the exceptions to that pattern that you found was that of a girl named, how do we pronounce it, Melandy?
It's Melandy, actually.
Melandy. And she was a student at the College of the Holy Cross. And would you just give us, as briefly as you can, just tell us about her circumstances?
Melanie had accused a friend of raping her in a public bathroom in an academic building on campus on the last night of her spring semester, freshman year, in May 2007. Melanie had been drinking that night, she says, for the first time, and she was inebriated. Her alleged attacker was also drinking. They were both at a party. They'd been hanging out together with friends. She says her alleged attacker lured her to this public bathroom and assaulted her, and she was incapable and unaware of resisting. And he says that she was a willing participant and had consensual sex. There was no physical evidence. There was no corroborating eyewitnesses of the alleged assault itself. It was a very difficult case to determine the truth, and we heard repeatedly from college administrators these kinds of he said, she said cases are very, very difficult for them to adjudicate.
But in this case, the person whom she accused was expelled.
And yes, he was found responsible.
I want to turn to Dean Irish at this point. I'm going to ask, what is the policy regarding sexual assault at the college, and why was this student expelled under that policy?
We have a very detailed descriptive policy in place, and these cases really hinge on two key items that we talk about from the time students come at orientation to the training of our boards around incapacitation through alcohol. And if somebody is incapacitated, they cannot give consent to engage in sexual activity. It's very clear in our handbook and throughout the information that we provide to students. And in prior to my arrival at Holy Cross in 2004, a lot of work had been done on really descriptive types of examples of what could be considered sexual assault.
Was this policy in place when this incident occurred?
Yes.
So both parties had reason to know what the rules were.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the young woman in this situation spoke to, you know, the clarity of the policy is something that was helpful for her as she's reviewing it and trying to weigh her options of whether she wanted to enter into a very unpleasant judicial proceeding. The language was there for her to look at and say, well, you know, I was incapacitated and I didn't give consent. And I think that was helpful for her.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about reporting spearheaded by the Center for Public Integrity that found that the rate of sexual assault on college campuses is high, but even more importantly, that men or young men who are found responsible for committing an act are rarely punished in any significant way. And we're talking about this with Kristen Lombardi, who's a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. We're also talking with Paul Irish from the College of the Holy Cross, and we're talking about a specific case that was an exception to this pattern where a young man was expelled after he was found responsible for assaulting a young woman, a friend. Kristen, when you met Melody, one of the things that stood out for me from this reporting is that she waited quite some time to report the assault. She had to know that it would have been difficult, but what made her want to go forward? What was it that made her say, I really have to go forward and pursue some action here?
What really prompted Melody, she told me, was returning to campus in the fall of 2008 and seeing her alleged attacker on campus and having to face him, not knowing when she would have to face him. Holy Cross is not a very big campus, and so when she walked around on campus, she could, you know, encounter him. And that is what I think prompted her to go to Holy Cross public safety officers.
She didn't go to law enforcement outside of the campus. She only pursued this complaint with campus public safety officers. Is that correct?
Yes. That's and correct. Melody was very aware of, I guess, the challenges, you would say, to adjudicating her case. She knew she was late in reporting. She knew she didn't have forensic evidence. She knew that it would be a question of credibility. She was intimidated by the criminal justice process. For those reasons, she felt like proving her case beyond a reasonable doubt would be really, really difficult. And she wanted to pursue the campus process first. She told us that she had it in her head that, you know, she would see how it goes with the campus process and perhaps pursue criminal charges. She ended up not pursuing criminal charges after her proceeding.
Why did these cases never become a matter for the criminal justice system?
Well, that is really dependent, I think, on the student themselves. The vast majority of them also went to local authorities and tried to press criminal charges. But oftentimes, local prosecutors chose not to take these cases. And they were left with campus judicial proceedings as their course of recourse.
So, Dean Irish, what was the process by which this case was investigated? What happens after a student or, I guess, presumably any member of the campus community comes forward with a complaint like this? What happens
sure.
then?
I think it happens before a student comes with a complaint through training our officers. Most of the officers at Holy Cross are trained sexual assault investigators so that it's not just a student versus student. But in this case, if a student went to public safety, we say that they drive the process. Do they want it to go to the DA? Do they want it to go to the student conduct office? You know, do they want it more time to make a decision on how they're going to proceed? So it's really empowering, you know, the student to make those decisions along the way.
Kristen, I commend you because you also sought out the other side of the story, which is the student who was expelled. And his name, you give him a pseudonym, Jordan?
Yes.
Right. So Jordan says that he was also intoxicated. And he says that this was consensual. And he, in this proceeding, he didn't have an advocate, which he would have had in criminal court. And I have to ask you, Dean, do you think that's fair?
I think it is, because it is a student-to-student hearing with advisors that are not advocates for them in a hearing, like you might think of as an attorney in a court of law. It's really the student asking the questions and answering them. And, you know, it is not a court of law. It's a hearing to determine whether the rules at our college about sexual misconduct were broken.
Well, what I'm having trouble with articulating is that there's something about this that is not the same as somebody sort of crawling into somebody's room or breaking down their door and assaulting them, that there are issues around conduct on both parties. And I sort of wondered, are women just kind of walking around as like potential victims here? Or are they being taught anything about the way they should conduct themselves in these situations? Do you know what I mean? I mean, has the pendulum swung from where like you're a good girl or you're a bad girl, and if you're not a good girl, then anything can be done to you and nobody's supposed to say anything, to the point where, you know, boys or young men are all potential predators and they're always responsible if something bad happens? You know what I mean? Do you hear
right.
what I'm saying?
But I think on college campuses, we've focused a lot on talking to young women about, you know, partying safe and not leaving your friend alone and watching your drink and that, but I think we haven't done enough with our young men to say, you know, if you get involved with a young woman and you do not know her all that well and you've been drinking, you know, this is a warning sign. This is not something that you want to engage in because of what possible consequences could be. And we know that in these situations that young men and women are not clearly communicating about, you know, what they want to engage in and what's okay in each step, you know, and that doesn't happen. And that's part of the confusion and the issue on our campuses.
And Krista, can I just ask you finally, did Jordan feel he had done anything wrong?
I would say no. And he was not different from any of the other students that accused students who were found responsible that we interviewed. You know, all of them still believe that they, or at least they maintained to us, that they had engaged in consensual sex. If they were found responsible, a lot of them believed and articulated to us that they felt that they were pressured to confess to the complaining student's version of events. I can't say that we spoke with anybody who felt in hindsight that they had done anything wrong, and that includes actually a student that we did interview in a Texas prison right now who had been accused of raping four Texas A&M students. And even he says that all four of those students had willingly engaged in sex, that college is about drinking and sex, and a lot of drunk sex goes on, and that's just the way it is. I think it's a really interesting question, actually, for educators.
And when you confronted him with the policy that said if, by definition, the other party is intoxicated and therefore consent cannot be given, what did he say to that?
You know, he basically believes that consent was given. Mm-hmm. That is what he believes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he mentioned that he was drinking as well. And he suggested that Melody was not too drunk to consent.
Is he bitter about what happened?
Well, he's very upset that he was expelled. He believes the process was unfair.
And how does she feel now? How does Melody feel now?
I think Melody would tell you that she's at peace. She is unlike all the other students that we've interviewed in the sense that she did not feel like she had to drop out. She's going to graduate in May. She told me she's ready to be somebody. And, you know, her process, her proceeding worked in her favor.
Well, you've raised some very rich and important issues with this reporting and with this series. And so, Kristen, we appreciate that. And Dean, we sure appreciate your taking the time to discuss this. So I wanted to ask for a final thought. Dean, what would you like people to draw from this?
Well, I think this is a pervasive problem on all our campuses. It's very underreported. And we really have to ask, why is it so underreported? What can we do to make victims feel comfortable to come forward, to feel supported, and to let people know that when there is an outcome, that it's a very serious outcome with everlasting, you know, life-altering, consequences.
Paul Irish is the Dean of Student Conduct and Community Standards at the College of the Holy Cross, and he was kind enough to join us from Boston. Kristen Lombardi is a staff writer at the Center for Public Integrity. She joined us from our bureau in New York. And I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
To hear more of NPR's investigative series on sexual assault on college campuses, please go to our website. Just go to npr.org.
The Latin alternative group Los Amigos Invisibles call Brooklyn their home, but Venezuela is their homeland. Last year, the country erupted in pride when the band won a Latin Grammy for their album Comercial. The group has a wide range of influences, from rock to funk to acid jazz. To get a better sense of what inspires them, lead guitarist Cheo shared what's currently topping his playlist for our segment In Your Ear.
Hello, my name is José Luis Cheo from Los Amigos Invisibles, and right now I'm really hooked in an old song called Lovely Day from Bill Withers.
Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
I went to see Steel Bill. It's a movie that they did about him, and I went to see him, and he was there doing a Q&A, and it was such a great experience, so I'm really in love with his music now, and this song has been, like, with me since then. Then I'm really hooked in Mayor Hawthorne and just ain't gonna work out.
Oh, baby, it'll be okay. And I don't wanna see you crying, darling.
I'm really happy that, you know, such a soulful musician is doing so well and he's getting a lot of attention because he's a great record. And also, I have to give my respect to Maluka. She's produced by Diplo, and she made like an amazing track called Grasso.
I went around your way. I went around your way. I went to 182nd and Autobahn just the other day.
It's like part of the new Dominican electro scene.
That was Jose Luis Pardo, better known as Cheo. He plays lead guitar for the Latin alternative band Los Amigos Invisibles. We'll be airing a performance by the group from our studios here in Washington later this month. And that's our program for today. I'm Lynn Neary, and for Michelle Martin, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.